or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the July 28, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are memory chip maker CXMT soared in its stock market debut to become the most valuable company listed in mainland China. Sector rotation in U.S. stocks helped keep major indexes on a relatively even keel, with the NASDAQ falling 0.2% and the Dow and S&P 500 rising 0.5% and less than 0.1% respectively. Oil prices plunged more than 5% after the U.S. paused military strikes against Iran, raising the prospect of renewed diplomatic efforts to end the war. Ford joined the competition to build the Army's newest tactical truck, a pickup that would double on the battlefield as a stealthy power bank on wheels. Cracker Barrel CEO Julie Masino, who proposed changes at the restaurant chain that alienated some diners, will step down and cede the role to an Outback veteran. J&J agreed to pay up to $5.5 billion to resolve remaining lawsuits that allege the company's talc products caused ovarian cancer. A former J.P. Morgan Chase employee accused the bank's leveraged finance team of racial discrimination and harassment in a lawsuit brought in federal court. Audi cut its full-year guidance as a worsening market in China and escalating tensions in the Middle East weigh on the automaker's performance. Porsche said that it would cut 5,000 jobs as part of a broader agreement with worker representatives and their powerful union. AstraZeneca said it is on track to hit its revenue target for 2030 as the company reported higher second quarter sales driven by its cancer medicines. Now for the key articles under the worldwide section. Ukrainian drones have hit military supply lines connecting Russia and Iran through the Caspian Sea, exploiting a new front in two increasingly intertwined wars. Alawian fighting between the U.S. and Iran has accelerated diplomacy aimed at finding a short-term fix to restart shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. Saudi Arabia said it intercepted a number of drones that Iran-backed militias in Iraq had launched at the kingdom's oil facilities. The Trump administration asked the Supreme Court to allow federal agencies to implement an executive order that would curb mail-in ballots ahead of the midterm elections. New York City halted construction work at another Manhattan office tower that is being converted into apartments over structural concerns. Three people were killed and four others wounded in what authorities believe was a gang-related shooting at a Seattle food festival. Trump, in recent weeks, expressed optimism about Ukraine and Volodymyr Zelensky in a remarkable change of fortune for Kyiv's wartime leader. Entries from Anthony Fauci's COVID-era journals, released by Senator Rand Paul, reveal the doctor's efforts to placate Trump while focusing on his media image. Former FBI Director James Comey urged a judge to throw out federal charges against him in connection with an image he posted on social media. Western governments are spending heavily to repatriate explosives manufacturing, with at least 24 new projects underway to make them across NATO countries. Senator Mitch McConnell and his staff released a new statement and photo, but did little to indicate whether the lawmaker will be able to return to work. The Port of Long Beach signed an agreement with federal regulators to explore the construction of a small nuclear reactor to power the port. The death toll from monsoon rains and flash flooding in Pakistan over the past month surpassed 100, and more heavy rain was expected across the country. The headline, Monsoon Floods Death Toll Tops 100 in Pakistan. And the picture on today's front page shows a mother holding a toddler and two boys alongside her wading through flood waters. And that caption reads, swamped. People wade through flood waters Monday after the Ravi River overflowed in Lahore, Pakistan. Flooding triggered by heavy monsoon rains has claimed more than 100 lives in the nation in the past month, and more rain is forecast. Articles from the front page follow. Fed chairman is now getting his wish, a good family fight. Warsh's tight-lipped approach to economy faces test this week as rate panel meets, by Nick Timiraos. On the evening of June 15th, before the first day of his first policy meeting as Fed Reserve chairman, Kevin Warsh sat down to dinner with the 18 officials who set interest rates alongside him. Gathered around a rectangular table, he announced his plan. Five panels of outside experts would spend the next few months examining how the Fed reads the economy and explains itself. Governor Christopher Waller, a former economics professor with a reputation for saying what others won't, put Warsh on the spot, according to several people familiar with the dinner. What's the point of all this? He asked. Tell me who you're putting on these groups, he said, and I'll tell you what they'll say. There were no brilliant ideas out there that everyone had somehow missed. The dinner was an early sign of the central tension of Warsh's chairmanship. He is determined to remake the Fed and convinced it can't afford to wait. Last year, Warsh persuaded the most rate-cut-hungry president in modern memory to hand the central bank to him, despite his long record of worrying about inflation. Now he faces another tricky sale, convincing his colleagues to abandon the intellectual habits of an economic profession he thinks led it astray. The Fed meets again this week with an outcome that is unusually uncertain. Many expect it to hold rates steady, but a renewed inflation scare has put a surprise increase in play. Part of why it is so hard to call is Warsh's signature early move on Fed reform. He is saying less about the economy, about where policy is headed, about his own thinking, and that silence is generating its own tension. Last month's dinner time exchange was, in one sense, exactly what Warsh says he wants, a good family fight, in the phrase he uses often, over outcomes not settled in advance. Waller had obliged, insinuating Warsh was importing outside authority to ratify long-held views and dressing them up as discovery. Warsh brims with confidence. His early verdict, delivered to lawmakers this month, in 6 weeks we have caused, I think, a sea change in new thinking. The 18 governors and Reserve Bank presidents who, with Warsh, make up the Interest Rate Setting Committee have received me incredibly warmly, he said. The culture he wants to instill is resonating. I hear it back in the hallways. I hear it in the cafeteria. Some of that warmth is his doing. Colleagues describe a talent for making people feel valued that succeeds even when they see it coming. The five Fed task forces on communications, its inflation framework, and its assets holdings, among others, are meant to reopen questions Warsh believes central bankers and the economics profession had stopped asking. The 15 people chosen to lead them include a Nobel laureate, former central bankers and business executives, and have drawn praise even from skeptics. Warsh says the reviews aren't designed to impose anything and that decisions will be left to the committee. The Fed has traditionally been reluctant to have outsiders do this work, and it moves slowly when it does. James Bullard, who ran the St. Louis Fed from 2008 to 2023, said Warsh has it right. Bringing in credible outsiders to gather input and report back, he said, is how you build support for change in any organization. I think he's spot on. Committee members have received the task forces with a mix of enthusiasm and reservation. There is genuine interest in revisiting issues like the balance sheet and communications that the Fed has deferred. There is also skepticism over whether Warsh's ambitious timeline and range of subjects will permit the kind of deliberation a committee this size needs to reach consensus. Sizzling debut propels Chinese chip firm. CXMT vaults to top value of a firm listed in mainland China, competition for U.S. by Raphael Wang and Sharada Dinesh. Memory chip maker CXMT soared in its stock market debut to become the most valuable company listed in mainland China, capping the rise of an upstart whose products are sought by Apple and adding to fears of competition for U.S. chip makers. CXMT, founded just a decade ago, sported a market capitalization equivalent to $484 billion after its opening day of trading in Shanghai, topping Industrial and Commercial Bank of China to become the most valuable company listed in a mainland Chinese market. CXMT's market value was just short of China-based internet company Tencent, which is listed in Hong Kong and is the most valuable company in that market. CXMT is China's national champion in the fast-growing business for memory chips, dominated until now by three companies, SK Hynix and Samsung of South Korea, and Micron Technology of the U.S. CXMT's offering came as chip stocks in the U.S. again declined, weighing on the NASDAQ Composite Index. Shares of NVIDIA fell 5% Monday, dragging its value below that of Apple. In addition to concerns about the CXMT debut, the Wall Street Journal reported that NVIDIA is in talks to provide a roughly $250 billion backstop for a massive open AI data center project, intensifying investor concerns about circular financing in the artificial intelligence economy. Apple on Monday snapped NVIDIA's 272 trading day streak as the largest U.S. company by market cap. The iPhone maker, which has never cracked the $5 trillion market cap threshold, is also closing in on that milestone. NVIDIA hit the $5 trillion milestone late last year. Apple reports quarterly earnings on Thursday. The exuberant investor response to CXMT's initial public offering in Shanghai followed the company's torrid growth in recent quarters. Shares in the IPO were sold at 8.66 yuan a share, equivalent to $1.28, a conservative price that reflected industry uncertainty and a desire to ensure a pop following the IPO, analysts said. Those lucky enough to win a lottery to buy shares at the IPO price saw their money more than quintuple, increasing 466% on the first day of trading, with the stock closing at 49 yuan. In the first quarter, CXMT's revenue rose to $7.5 billion from less than $1 billion a year earlier. Profit rose to $3.66 billion as the memory chip shortage allowed the company to secure generous price increases from customers. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Ukraine-Iran Wars Converge in Caspian by Jared Malzin. Istanbul. Ukrainian drones have hit military supply lines connecting Russia and Iran through the Caspian Sea, exploiting a new front in two increasingly intertwined wars. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed responsibility for the strikes, saying in a tweet Saturday, "We also achieved very strong results with long-range strikes in the Caspian Sea, including vessels used in military cargo shipments involving Iran, as well as a warship." The Security Service of Ukraine, an intelligence agency, said that it launched drone strikes in the Caspian against a Russian oil field, a Russian missile boat, and ships used to transport Iranian drones to Russia. The strikes, part of a long-range drone campaign that also has reached deep into Russia, has brought Iran and Ukraine one step closer to a direct confrontation. For years, Iran has supplied lethal drones that Russia has used against Ukraine, while the Kremlin has helped Tehran this year with intelligence to assist in its response to the U.S. and Israeli bombing campaigns. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi blamed Zelensky on Sunday for a strike that he said killed a sailor on an Iranian commercial vessel. Araghchi said in a social media post that he phoned Russian and European Union leaders to say that Kyiv's actions couldn't go unanswered. Iran summoned the Ukrainian charged affairs in Tehran. The strikes come at a critical time in both the Iran and Ukraine wars. President Trump paused strikes on Iran over the weekend while weighing a possible escalation in attacks intended to break Iran's grip on the Strait of Hormuz. The Caspian trade offers Iran one way to circumvent a U.S. military blockade of its ports along the Persian Gulf and the North Arabian Sea. Iran's southern oil exporting ports are more important for Iran's economy, but the Caspian Sea is Iran's most direct route to Russia, which has become an increasingly important military partner as both countries remain entrenched in war. The sea allows Iran a route to Russia and onward to Central Asia that is somewhat unfettered by any kind of interdiction by the United States or other partners, said Nicole Grodzicki, assistant professor at the Center for International Research at Sciences Po University in Paris, and the author of a book on the Russia-Iran partnerships. Meanwhile, Ukraine's drone strikes inside Russia have given it a new advantage in the more than four-year-old war. Ukraine has used long-range drone strikes in recent months to attack oil refineries as far away as Siberia, contributing to an energy crisis inside a country that is one of the world's largest petroleum producers. Targeting the Caspian, more than 430 miles from Ukraine's nearest border, gives Kyiv an opportunity to disrupt Moscow's links with Tehran. The attacks also could help Ukraine generate support within the Trump administration, security analysts said. U.S. cities face drop in children. Big metro areas confront rapid decline of resident families with kids. By Rachel Louise Enzen and Paul Overberg. When Fernando and Patricia Escobedo moved to the Willows, an affluent neighborhood in El Paso, Texas, 25 years ago, kids were everywhere. About half of the homes on their cul-de-sac had children. Growing up, the couple's twin daughters used to ride their scooters outside with other neighborhood kids. At an annual block party, they jumped around in a bouncy house and climbed into the local fire truck. The twins are now in college, and the neighborhood feels a lot different. The Escobedos also have a 12-year-old at home, and Fernando said she is one of a few children under 18 on the block. The local elementary school has noticeably fewer kids. Fernando said he's more likely to see a retired neighbor gardening than a child on a bike. It's not the vibe it was 10 years ago when there were still kids here, he said. With the nation's fertility rate at record lows, the number of children under 18 is falling across the U.S. The decline is especially pronounced in big cities, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis. The number of children under 18 living in big U.S. cities is down 6% in the past decade, the journal found, compared with a 1% decline nationwide. The drop is especially stark among families with little kids. The number of children under age 5 in big cities fell 15%, compared with a drop of 7% nationwide. Even cities that are gaining population are losing children. Whistleblower set off probe of Dodgers owner, by Margot Patrick, Justin Barr, Andrew Beaton, and Dave Michaels. The problems for Mark Walters' sprawling sports and finance empire began with an internal whistleblower complaint. The complaint questioned how Walters' asset management firm, Guggenheim Investments, booked revenue from dealings with insurance companies and had drawn interest from federal prosecutors by last year, people familiar with the matter said. Within months, the investigation evolved to focus on investments in private credit, a lending business that has boomed on Wall Street in the past decade and a half, and which supplied the financial firepower for Walters' 2012 acquisition of the Los Angeles Dodgers alongside partners. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan and the Securities and Exchange Commission are now examining how around $16 billion in loans extended to companies tied to Walter or his conglomerate, TWG Global, wound up on the books of insurance companies he owns after passing through a third entity, the people familiar with the matter said. The authorities are trying to determine whether the activity constituted fraud, one of the people said. Such related party transactions must be disclosed to insurance regulators, a rule meant to limit conflicts of interest and protect policyholders. Walters' insurance firm said in recent filings that they had reviewed their transactions after receiving subpoenas and had identified problems with how certain transactions were presented. The probe marks a serious threat to the complex business empire assembled by Walter. The 66-year-old profile has risen from his ownership stakes in the Dodgers and other marquee sports franchises such as the Los Angeles Lakers and Chelsea Football Club, but his businesses operate under the radar and their inner workings aren't widely understood. The investigation comes as regulators are starting to take more interest in the opaque world of private credit, which took off after the financial crisis of 2008-09 and has become a rival to banks in extending loans to businesses. A big chunk of the money fueling that industry is coming from life insurers such as the ones Walter owns. You think you found the one? Then you crunch the numbers. Young adults are consulting spreadsheets to grade their dates. Friends Feedback Tab by Molly Reinman. Carolyn Travis was smitten by a man she met in an entrepreneurship course. It took a spreadsheet to realize the relationship was doomed. After a few dates, the 27-year-old debriefed her two best friends over lunch. When she went to the bathroom, they got to work. They plugged Travis's core values into an app one of the friends built to assess compatibility. Then they entered everything they knew about her date, an engineer more than a decade her senior. The spreadsheet crunched the numbers. The result? A portrait of incompatibility. Her perspective shifted. She saw him a few more times before breaking things off. Now she uses the app called Spread to track all of her dating data. Golf's next prodigy wins his first PGA Tour title, by Andrew Beaton. It was perfectly understandable when Jackson Koivun felt a bit jittery on the final hole of the PGA Tour's 3M Open on Sunday. Koivun, a 21-year-old, making just his third start as a professional, had spent his afternoon having to play near perfect golf to withstand a charge from none other than world number one Scottie Scheffler. And now, with victory in sight, a poor chip had left him with a 14-footer for par. But that didn't turn out to be a problem. Koivun's talent shone through, and he sank the putt anyway. At that moment, everyone in the golf world knew what it meant. The player hyped up as golf's next big thing for years had fully arrived. I had quite a few nerves, Koivun said afterward. Then I knew where I stood and what I had to do to secure the win. Koivun went from turning pro barely a month ago to winning a $1.6 million payday, and he did it in emphatic fashion. At 25 under par, he bested Scheffler by 3 strokes and set the tournament scoring record. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, The Revealing Diaries of Dr. Fauci. Newly released diaries tell a different story from what he told you. Anthony Fauci made himself the public face of pandemic lockdowns in 2020, and now we have a glimpse of what was going on behind his eyes. Newly released diaries paint an unflattering portrait of a self-obsessed and not entirely honest bureaucrat, in contrast to the image of the careful scientist he cultivated in public. The documents were released by Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who for years has dug into the COVID story to understand why the government response to the health crisis was so destructive. The excerpt Senator Paul has published, which run to more than 1,100 pages, cover December 2019, just before the first reports of an outbreak in Wuhan, China, through Dr. Fauci's retirement from government in December 2022. The diary reads as if it was intended to be an aide memoir for an autobiography Dr. Fauci might write one day, so it pays to read with care. He might have shaded the truth with an eye or two on history, yet that possibility makes what's in it all the more remarkable. One conclusion is that on important points, Dr. Fauci was both wrong and dishonest. For instance, he and allies in the government science industrial complex still cling to the theory that COVID-19 evolved naturally in animal populations before spreading to humans. Yet on February 1st, 2020, his diary records a meeting with a dozen prominent virologists in which only 2 credited his natural origins theory. The rest suspected the virus might have been created artificially, not least because a leading scientist in Wuhan, Shi Zhengli, was known to engage in the sort of gain-of-function research that could produce such a result. The diary suggests that by January 26, 2020, Dr. Fauci believed the virus hadn't originated in the Wuhan wet market, often identified as the source by natural origin advocates. This didn't stop him and allies from painting skeptics of the natural origin theory as politicized cranks and conspiracy theorists. Previously released documents shed light on how Dr. Fauci orchestrated publication of a scientific paper to suppress the theory that COVID leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The diary also brags on Dr. Fauci's influence persuading the likes of California Governor Gavin Newsom and then New York Mayor Bill de Blasio to shut schools and lock down large parts of the economy. Yet he later claimed in public that he never argued for locking anything down. Liberals lionize Dr. Fauci now for his antagonism toward President Trump. But early in the pandemic, the diary suggests the doctor was besotted with Mr. Trump, mainly, it appears, because Mr. Trump said nice things about him. He's similarly susceptible to the flattery of celebrities. Conversely, Dr. Fauci gloated to himself about his viciousness toward critics. July 14, 2020 saw him trying to quash a skeptical memo about his policies by journal contributor Stephen Moore. I told White House aide Elisa Farah that the White House, either Meadows or the POTUS, need to shut up Stephen Moore and stop his publication of Dr. Wrong paper. If he does not, the entire academic community will dump all over the POTUS. He attempted to freeze lockdown skeptics out of policymaking roles. He refers to Jay Bhattacharya, Sunitra Gupta, and Martin Kulldorff, authors of the lockdown critical Great Barrington Declaration, as the Three Stooges. The most embarrassing entries relate Dr. Fauci's fixation with his own press coverage. He makes a note of his many interviews, and a positive newspaper profile can garner as much mention in the diary as the important scientific and policy debates of that day. The media idolatry is something to behold, and maybe one reason that most of the press will ignore the diaries. They incriminate the press in Dr. Fauci's deceptions. Amazing profile of me today on Nightline, he writes at one point. Multiple editorials, print news, Washington Post, etc., and opinion pieces, Newsweek, written about me. Cannot keep up or even read all of them. Country needs someone to look up in face of Trump presidency. All of which points to a larger lesson still unlearned from the COVID debacle. The doctor of the diaries comes across as all too human, stubborn, biased, vain, and vindictive. Yet the media and most of the political class treated him as a Solomonic sage, the perfect technocrat capable of managing all of society. The COVID record shows that his advice was often wrong, and in the case of the lockdowns, catastrophically so. This is why voters increasingly rebel against rule by experts. After reading the Fauci diaries, the real question is why we'd ever allow such a person to rule over us in that way again. The White House missile gap excuse, A remarkable thing happened this weekend with too little attention. In the middle of a war with Iran, officials in the Trump administration leaked to the press that the U.S. is running out of ammunition. That was the explanation officials offered CNN and other news outlets for President Trump's decision to stop his nightly bombing of Iran over its closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Mull over that one. Mr. Trump was saying all last week he is prepared for a major military escalation. But suddenly, the leakers undermine the credibility of that U.S. resolve by telling the press, and thus the Iranians, that the U.S. can't sustain the fight? Do the leakers think this public admission of weakness will make the Iranians more likely to open the strait? Do they think it's wise to tell enemies trying to kill U.S. soldiers not to worry about a sustained American response? This is an astonishing display of incompetence or disloyalty or both. If the U.S. really is running out of missiles and interceptors, that should be a five-alarm fire. Mr. Trump should be calling on Congress to skip its recess and do something about it immediately, and rallying industry for the effort. But if the missile gap is being floated for political purposes by officials who want Mr. Trump to stand down, then the president should banish those voices from the Situation Room. Either way, they're laughing in Tehran. Trump is wrong about the filibuster. The 60-vote rule helps the Conservative Party, and the Save America Act isn't worth it. Bad ideas are everywhere in Washington, but here's one that belongs in a Hall of Fame. President Trump is again pressing Republicans to nuke the Senate's 60-vote filibuster rule to pass the Save America Act, or, in other words, hand progressives the tools to pack the Supreme Court and create new states in exchange for a voting bill that isn't a clear political winner for the GOP. John Thune should not allow the United States Senate to leave town until it passes the Save America Act, or far better still, terminates the filibuster, where Republicans can then quickly pass everything they've ever dreamed of, Mr. Trump wrote Monday online. He argued the GOP is ceding the advantage if it doesn't use the nuclear option first. The Democrats will do it on day one. Will they? It's possible. But they didn't under President Biden, despite similar pressure from the left, which also wanted to pass everything it ever dreamed of. The Democrats who publicly refused were Senator Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. While neither remains in office, the question was always how many Democrats quietly agreed with them and didn't want to take the heat for saying so. One now daring to step up is Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman. He campaigned on killing the filibuster in 2022, but subsequent events have vindicated Ms. Sinema and Mr. Manchin, he wrote Monday in the Washington Post. Mr. Fetterman praised the filibuster for forcing compromise and urged voters who dislike Mr. Trump's agenda to imagine a world without the 60-vote rule. Republicans could fundamentally change the entire government and country with a simple majority vote. The same mental exercise in the other direction could benefit frustrated Republicans. If the filibuster went away, Democrats with a mere 50 votes plus a vice presidential tiebreaker could wreck the Supreme Court, add new states, pass Medicare for all, prohibit right-to-work laws, codify Roe versus Wade, create a national gun registry, raise the minimum wage to $25 an hour, and so much more. The GOP might hope to undo such policies while passing a wish list of its own when it next controls Congress and the White House. Yet the effect would be highly destabilizing, and progressives would have the clear advantage. If Democrats pack the Supreme Court with four new justices who have life tenure, would Republicans unpack it later? Doubtful. After Democrats passed new entitlements year after year, would Republicans marshal the votes for repeal? They can't even repeal the taxes in Obamacare. Think how hard it was for Republicans to pass even modest Medicaid reform last year. The filibuster benefits the country by ensuring stability, so national policy isn't constantly flipping between polar extremes. This also happens to help the Conservative Party because it makes radical change hard to enact. Breaking the filibuster would remove a structural check on the ability of temporary majorities to fundamentally reshape American society, which is what progressives want to do. Even if Republicans moved first, as Mr. Trump wants, the result in the long run would be a ratchet clicking steadily to the left. And in exchange for the Save America Act, a terrible trade. Whether or not Mr. Trump truly believes that hordes of illegal voters are the only reason Republicans ever lose, it isn't true. That bill would make most drivers' licenses insufficient to register to vote, and Democrats would mandate universal ballot harvesting at their first chance. Mr. Thune has said over and over that there aren't 50 votes to kill the filibuster, and thank goodness. Doing it for the Save America Act would be like robbing a bank to steal $15. Hang tough, Mr. Thune. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, Mayo meets Manhattan. Mayor Mandani vilifies landlords in the manner of the Cultural Revolution, by William McGurn. Pity the landlord. In communist China in the 1940s and 50s, landlords became class enemies and were publicly denounced in Speak Bitterness campaigns. An estimated 1 million to 2 million of them were murdered. Today, Chairman Mayo has morphed into the friendlier face of Mayor Mandani. Government isn't murdering landlords, but even as Zoran Mandani denies that the democratic socialism he champions is communism, he has embraced the same vilification and targeting of landlords. In mid-July, the New York mayor released a report with 23 policy actions on everything from building inspections to combating mold. The report's title gives away the game: The Rental Ripoff Hearing Report. Reading it, you would think there isn't a single landlord in the city who treats his tenants decently and keeps his buildings in good repair. There's a method to Mr. Mandani's madness. Even the barest acquaintance with the record of rent control and other government efforts to keep housing costs down by subsidizing rents or artificially capping them shows they usually end in failure. The mayor will need to deal with the coming failure or distract attention from it. Enter Saul Alinsky, the community activist in Chicago who wrote Rules for Radicals. For Mayor Mandani, Rule 13 offers a path forward. Pick the target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. It's simple. Pick someone you can blame everything on and attack. In a city where most people have a landlord and renters outnumber owners 2-1, landlords are a fat target. If, like Marx, you believe rent is robbery, say so. Make a campaign of it. Mayor Mandani took note and has taken aim. He was elected in good part on a campaign promise to freeze the rent for every rent-stabilized tenant, as he put it last year. It's true. As your next mayor, I will freeze your rent. Economically, it's disastrous, but politically, it's brilliant. Largely because there's no expenditure, except for the increased costs borne by the landlords. But the goal isn't merely to shift costs to the private sector. It's much more than targeting a few apartments in bad shape, says Howard Husick, author of The Projects, A New History of Public Housing, and a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Mandani is villainizing landlords as a class. For him, the problem is private ownership itself. Picking up on echoes of the Chinese Cultural Revolution, Mr. Husick adds, next, he'll require them to wear dunce caps. Late last month, Mr. Mandani made good on his promise when the New York City Rent Guidelines Board hit landlords with a rent freeze. The move affects 1- and 2-year leases on rent-stabilized apartments. According to the board, there are about 1 million such apartments, a bit less than half of the city's 2.3 million rental units. A roughly equal number are market rate or unregulated. There are also about 177,500 units managed by New York City Housing Authority. Another 24,000 units are rent-controlled. Rent-controlled apartments are occupied by tenants who have continuously lived there since 1971 and have stricter controls on rent prices. Rent stabilization applies to housing built between 1947 and 1974, with rent increases limited by annual percentage caps announced by the Rent Guidelines Board, whose members are appointed by the mayor. At a time when New Yorkers are squeezed by higher cost, Mr. Mandani knows that landlords make a great scapegoat, especially when the system is stacked against them. That's also the gist of the legal argument a small group of landlords are making in a lawsuit seeking to overturn the Mandani rent freeze. Most of the arguments raised in the 128-page suit are devoted to showing that the mayor determined the outcome of the vote he wanted first, and then rigged the process by manipulating the data. The landlords are right to complain, but the real problem isn't just the rent freeze. It's the whole idea of government-controlled rent. It has consistently delivered a discount for a privileged slice of New Yorkers while making it worse for everyone not in on the game. Repairs and upkeep slow down or cease. Even worse, government regulation and intervention reduces the supply of new housing, and new housing is the only way to to bring down prices. Eli Steele is the filmmaker behind the upcoming documentary White Guilt, which challenges the whole narrative of public vilification. Just yesterday, we were putting people into the oppressor box based on tribal characteristics, says Mr. Steele. Now it's by profession? That's a very dangerous leap in our society and culture. Sunday shopping, that thing you don't. Will Germany adapt to the digital world and let stores open 7 days a week? By Bob Green. In the much-loved movie, That Thing You Do, set in the summer of 1964, Mr. Patterson, owner of a small appliance store in downtown Erie, Pennsylvania, reads the local newspaper in his almost empty store and grows visibly upset. He is looking at an advertisement for a nearby appliance chain megastore. He says to his wife and children, who also work in his store, "Open on Sunday from 12 to 6. You know, I don't believe I want to live in a country where you have to stay open on Sunday to do business. You shouldn't have to work on Sunday to support a family, should you?" Americans growing up in the 21st century might be puzzled by these words, because the idea of widespread Sunday business closings has, with notable exceptions, been disappearing for decades. So-called blue laws, intended to mandate a day of rest, including worship, were once quite common. In states and municipalities where the no sales on Sunday standard wasn't locked in by legislation, it was established by local tradition. Hence, Mr. Patterson versus the Superstore. Today, there is a high-profile battle in Germany over a long-standing national ban that prohibits most retailers from opening on Sundays so that citizens may have a day of rest from work and of spiritual elevation. Some stores are allowed to open, but are limited to selling government-certified necessities. The journal's Bertrand Benoit reports from Berlin that in otherwise vibrant business districts, on Sundays, iron curtains roll shut, turning city centers into eerie, echoey deserts. Amid a challenging economy, some German politicians are trying to change the law so stores can operate 7 days a week. Remnants of the old blue laws remain in some American states or localities where regulations place restrictions on the retail sale of alcohol on Sundays, or idiosyncratically prohibit auto dealers from selling cars. Pockets of resistance, including Bergen County, New Jersey, continue to prohibit most retailers from selling anything other than necessities. But in a world where online retailers are open 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, brick and mortar merchants can find themselves at a distinct disadvantage if they aren't able to sell on Sundays. It's one thing when a business elects to lock its doors, as Chick-fil-A does. Founder S. Truett Cathy decided in 1946 that he and his employees